What is up, Knoll Nation? It's the guys from Plant the Spear back with you for another episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. Michael, if this is like Sesame Street, word of the day is lawsuit. And it really seems like that's the word of the offseason. I can't wait till we get back to football season to talk about actual sports. But, you know, it's been lawsuits here with FSU and the ACC. We just talked about last week with our last episode with a lawsuit with Jaden Rashad in Florida.
That's right.
This one's a little bit different, though. Now, it's not fully settled yet, so let's say that. So we don't know the entirety of how it's going to turn out, but this is going to change college sports forever.
Yes.
So amateurism in college sports, as we know it, has officially died. Put it in the ground, bury it, it's over. So we are now moving.
Take a drink, pour it out for them.
Yeah, pour a little bit of the 40 out for the homie amateurism, because it is done. So college sports is going to move to a paid model, and that's what we're going to talk about today primarily. And then Florida State baseball. Hosting a regional top eight national seed. Got some things to talk about. ACC championship didn't really end how we had hoped it would, but hopefully they can make some noise in the regional. We have some good news to share there as well. So we'll get into that at the tail end of this episode. So again, thanks guys for tuning in. And Michael, thank you for joining me, my friend. How are you?
Well, thanks, Jesse, for having me again. Yeah, man, you know, it looked like it was going to be a great weekend watching FSU baseball, kind of just checking out that. And again, postseason, you know, sadness for FSU. I think I sent you a text and said, man, what is it about this sports year postseason for Florida State? It's just been so hard with softball, with baseball. You know, now, luckily, baseball's not over just yet, so we still have another ability to go get some hardware. But and obviously with Florida State football as well, too. But you know what? I'm gonna be positive. I'm going to look out for the bright side.
Yeah, I mean, baseball's still got a ways to go, and we were talking about this before the show. I think a run to Omaha probably feels better at the end of the season than winning an ACC championship where you already have a regular season champion that's been named in North Carolina. So, but we'll get into that during the baseball. I think you guys, you know, whether or not you're an FSU baseball fan, I think you'll enjoy that part. We got some news and notes coming up for the regional that I want to share with you guys. But, Michael, let's jump into this massive change, because this affects football. This affects baseball, basketball, basically every sport touched by the NCAA. So I'm going to throw a slide up for those of you watching on YouTube. Those listening on the podcast, will go through it one by one so you can stay up to date as where we're at as well. And we'll just kind of – how we'll approach this is we'll go into what it is and then what it means for Florida State, college football, college sports in general. So let's start out with what this is. This is the House versus NCAA settlement. And so this is going to end up ruling that athletes can be paid directly by schools, basically through a revenue sharing model. So this ruling will settle three pending federal antitrust lawsuits, and it will pay past players all the way dating back to 2016, not every past player, but the ones back to 2016, approximately 14,000 athletes is what they're saying. And it provides compensation model for current athletes over the next 10 years. And this settlement is going to be somewhere around $2.7 to $2.8 billion. The athletes can no longer sue the NCAA for antitrust violations because, you know, on a side note, realistically, with the NCAA, this is one of those where, man, they took the settlement because they know the damages could have got a lot worse. And like the NCAA was on the guillotine. They were ready to be put to bed probably forever. And they, you know, they fought it off again. So it's like a cat with nine lives. I don't know what number they're on, but they got to be getting close to nine. And I think in the long run, we may test that theory coming up. The revenue sharing plan allows for each school to share up to $20 million. And of course, we're going to share some additional details because that's for all sports, not just football. Potential scholarship and roster changes coming from the NCAA in light of this. All in projected costs for Power 5 conference schools will be around $30 million once you figure in past compensation, current compensation, and additional scholarship costs. Now, again, like we mentioned, originally this deal is not formally finalized with many details still to be worked out. It has to go back to the plaintiff to make sure they're good with it, and then it goes to a judge to be finalized. So it's not over yet. We don't know the details yet, but we have a pretty good framework of where this is at. And so with the initial points that we just put out, I'll let you share some initial thoughts, and then we'll kind of go into a few more of the details that we know and what it means for Florida State and college sports in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. Like, it seems like the NCAA just has an unlimited amount of life, because right when you think they're dead, right when their like power bar gets to like two, they somehow find a med kit somewhere and they like if you play Fortnite, they just get all the way back. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jess, I think this was an attempt to settle three different lawsuits that they were facing that were basically, I don't know if the judge said it, or I don't know if basically they recognize it, but they were going to lose. And in totality, it was somewhere around like $20 billion, which if they had, you know, pursued this lawsuit all the way to the fullest extent and they lost, that would have been the end. That would have been the death toll, death nail to the NCAA, to college athletics, you know, in general.
Right. It would have bankrupted them.
It would have bankrupted the entire NCAA. There would have been no way they could have afforded it, right? So by the fact of them being able to agree to the settlement, and again, as Jesse said, like, this is not finalized. Like, the plaintiff, the people that are the athletes that are suing, they have to agree to this. The judge has to agree to this. So either one of them could literally say nope, and they're right back at the drawing table.
Yeah.
But the chances of that, based on what we've read, and again, we're not Twitter, we're not lawyers on Twitter. We're Twitter lawyers, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
As you said, and so we don't fully understand or know all of it. But what we can gather is that the chances of this, of them rejecting the settlement, is, it feels slim. But who knows, right? And so I think this is huge. It's a huge thing for college athletics. It's going to change the what we know. Like, so for those of us, like, I know Jesse, you and me and other, we're like purists. Like, we love college football in its purest form, where student athletes, you know, yes, they should get money for their name, image, and likeness, but we never imagined it would get to this. We miss those days. Well, those days are dead and gone for sure. So we got to get over it. And this is what college athletics is going to look like moving forward, man.
No, I 100% agree. And it's just, you may not like it, but you have to accept it, because this is where it's moving. And in a way, now, again, there's so much framework that has to be figured out with this, because this is somewhat by the NCAA of an attempt to control the NIL market from the past that we've seen, where there is no control, where the courts have basically shot down every bit of rules that you could have. Right. So if you kind of bring it in-house to where the schools are paying people, then you can kind of come to an agreement where you have salary caps and all this stuff. And you know, NIL originally, in its original form, was not meant to be pay for play, but that is what we've seen. And we've seen pay for play come about in an unregulated market where you can basically pay whatever you want. So at least this moves to kind of that NFL pro model, where you have, you know, you may see roster changes and scholarship level changes, and we're going to talk about all that as well, but you'll see salary caps. Now, the thing that is still to be answered is, are these teams going to be able to go above and beyond that $20 million number every single year with a collective? So, like, can Florida State put $20 million towards sports, and then the Battles End can throw another $20 million on top? Because if you're looking to make things fair across the board, if that's what you're attempting to do, you know, if you watch Major League Baseball, or if you've seen the Moneyball movie, you know, just because you have a certain amount of roster spots doesn't mean you're spending the same amount on roster. So that's if you have, if you have a hard floor and a glass ceiling, everybody's got to spend $20 million, great. But you can also have a school like Texas or Texas A&M or Georgia, Alabama, where the big money schools could spend twice that if they wanted to, which again is another reason why the revenue gap, which we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, is growing ever more important. Now, the one thing that I think is interesting about this, Michael, is this is technically not an employee model yet. This is just a revenue sharing model.
Correct.
But me just thinking, just kind of thinking on my own accord here, is this deal covers 10 years.
Yep.
And so that means at some point after that 10 years, a new deal will have to get negotiated. Now, we see this happen in pro sports all the time. It's called a collective bargaining agreement. Right. Currently, as it stands, the NCAA doesn't really have like a players union. And so is that going to be something that's going to be formed, where you now have a players union for when that comes around, that negotiation period comes around, they have a voice in the say too. And if you move to that, will you move, you know, you start bringing up unions and stuff like that. Yeah. Will you move to that employee model? And if you move to that employee model, at that point, you don't really need the NCAA anymore. Nope. So I think you're looking at doing, in the future, this could be, and that's why I said they might have fought off that, you know, losing that ninth life, but it's coming for them. You know, they're still being chased. And so I think you will still see the eventual death of the NCAA. And I also think that this is going to move towards that power conference, really the four, maybe even super conferences, because again, when you bring up revenue gap, you say power four, but the Big 12 and the ACC are miles behind in a growing revenue gap. So will they even be able to compete? So it may, this is going to lead towards that super conference environment is what I feel, because this really separates the haves and the have nots. Because when you look at $20 million a year, that's not really a big deal to an athletic department like Ohio State, who has the largest budget in the country at around $250 million, or even Florida State at $161 million.
Yeah.
But what about some of the smaller schools that are still in FBS, still in Division I, but not in the Power Five? Like, I think it was, I saw where Louisiana Monroe has an athletic budget of around $19 million.
Wow.
So this is their entire athletic budget. So you're going to separate these two. And, and I think it's funny that it comes at a time where you have playoff expansion that still includes them. So now you are going to have your mega giants competing again. You know, they're going to have to be David versus Goliath almost every single year, or break off and then just form the power conferences. But, you know, again, man, it's going to be kind of crazy, because this presents so many different things. This will allow for transparency, because if these players are being paid by the schools, then those will be legal financial documents that will be open to the public with Freedom of Information Act requests for at least public universities. So now we'll know how much these kids are getting paid. You know, right now I think there's a lot of assumptions in NIL. There's a lot of assumptions that, you know, every kid's getting a Benz and a $1 million. A Benz in a bag, which some are. Some would probably shock you if you knew how much they got. I mean, we just saw the crazy deal with Jaden Rashada that we talked about, which this should prevent that because of transparency. If you promise that money, you'll have to follow through with it. But, you know, how is that going to feel when you have all this money, or you see all these kids making all this money? How will people want to fund collectives? You know, I mean, if you make $50,000 a year and your quarterback makes $5 million, you might not be so inclined, to be paying into that collective. How does this do with the division among sports? Because this $20 million is not just for football. This is for everybody else. You know, so how does that go over in the athletic department when you're funding football with 15 out of the 20 million for a football school, and you're dividing the rest up? Or if you're a basketball school like a Kentucky or Kansas, you're probably going to put a majority of your money towards a basketball program. And that's, we've already seen the Kentucky coaches when Calipari was there, him and Mark Stoops, they already argued over
whether they
were a basketball or a football school. And you'll find out when you see how much
real they put
towards it. Right. And then the last thing, and I'll throw back to you on this as well, as far as the transparency, is how does this go in the locker room when you find out that that guy makes $5 million and maybe you're a guy that, okay, you don't have as big an impact on the team, but you're making like $30,000 and it's not even close.
Yeah.
It's going to be, I think there are aspects where this will be good. And I think where there are aspects that will be a bumpy ride getting there. Oh, but I think ultimately, because of where we're at, you know, if you went from no NIL to this, it would be a shocking change. You would be like, the college game that we know it is over and done with. But I think because of where we're at now, with NIL still exists, it's just completely off the rails. This feels good for the future of the sport. Oh,
yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, man, there's just so much to talk about with this. Like, when you talk about the cap, you know, like you said, it's $20 million for just – but that $20 million up to $30 million is really the Power 5 schools, Power 4, whatever you want to call it, since the Pac-12 is almost officially dead. And so those group of five schools, those small schools, they're chunk into, partial payment of the settlement if it goes through, and then paying of athletes. There's going to be a lot smaller than the Power 4 schools are. The Power 4 schools will have that $20 million set aside. So when you talk about that cap, like you said, I think it's a great – it's a great dialogue and question, because for a school like, you know, let's say UCF, you know, here in Orlando, $20 million, but that's probably all they could really do.
Right.
Whereas, like you said, Ohio State or another, you know, big time school, Big Ten or SEC, they're going to have the $20 million plus the additional money. I know we'll get to that in a second about the revenue sharing from TV contract, but they're going to have additional money. Is it a true salary cap? You know, the NCAA is trying to incorporate here because it really isn't And the only way it becomes a true salary cap is through the collective bargaining. And right. So what the NCAA has done is basically a poor man's way of trying to move towards a collective bargaining agreement. The problem with that, though, is they're also out there. They're, you know, what's the saying? You're talking out of two sides of your mouth there.
Yeah. You're okay. Talking out of both sides of your mouth.
Yeah. Talking out of both sides of your mouth. Because on one side, they're saying, yes, we want to move to this kind of deal. And it's a quasi collective bargaining, blah, 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 blah. We can play players. But on the other side, they're also petitioning Congress to create laws to not make student athletes employees.
Right.
You cannot bargain unless they are employees and they unionize. Right. And so, again, this is where the mess is in this model. It's like it's a temporary Band-Aid. It's like getting like a cannonball gutted through your belly, and then you're putting like a little Band-Aid over it. Like
right,
there's a
right,
hole like, in your belly.
Exactly, because the argument, like you said, that they're not employees is eventually going to be the death of the NCAA
exactly.
if they go to that. So this kicked the can down the road. Like, they just fought off King Kong only to walk into Godzilla waiting
exactly.
on them. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Like, I like that. Exactly.
There's still things out there to figure out for them, too.
Exactly. And then the question becomes, okay, well, if this was supposed to help with NIL things, well, we all knew. First of all, let's just be real. Let's just call a spade here, right? Paying for play was happening long before the NIL
right.
came
yep,
to
exactly.
be. I'm not saying Florida State's guilty of this. I'm not saying anybody right. else is guilty of this, right? I'm just saying we all know we were paying players long before this became a thing. NIL was supposed to be name, image, and likeness, meaning that Jesse or I, if we were Division I athletes, gosh, I wish we were right now, but yeah. if we were Division I athletes, we could go to a car dealership and say, hey, I will drive around your car. I will shoot commercials if you pay me this much money. What it became was, oh, if we, the fans, give to this collective, then they will give money to the players, the collective mm-hmm. will, not the school, and then it's basically inducement, right? And
right.
so this idea of the $20 million was supposed to help cure some of those laws. Well, here's a question for you, Jesse. Like you said, if the schools are now allowed to pay players, we'll get to know what they make. But if the collectives are still part of it, the collectives are private nonprofit. They don't mm-hmm. have to report what they give. So we will only know, again, just a partial truth of what a player makes. We don't know on
right.
like so if a player is making $1 million, but they're only getting $200,000 from the school, we won't know if they're making $600,000 or $800,000 from the collectives, because the collectives aren't required to report that information unless the school brings the collective under them, which then they would be required. But that's the
right.
thing. Like, so some of this is still trying to be worked out and figured out in that process.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's still a lot of gray area to be answered, because like you said, I mean, it's a great point. We basically have moved from McDonald's bags of
yes.
cash to now NIL payments, which make absolutely no sense, where it's like, all right, man, you reading a 30-second ad for Bojangles or like a car dealership, is that really worth $5 million a year? And if
exactly.
so, like, how do I get in on that? You know, but
Bojangles, call us.
Exactly. Like, I love chicken tenders, man. Hook me up. But I think it really is because it's not about your value as a brand. It's about inducing to pay. And so
that's
now
right.
you've just basically got to where you went from McDonald's bags to private deals, essentially
private deals.
Shady deals, to now you're just going to get a paycheck.
Correct.
And so it's brought the sport to where it needs to be.
Yes.
It's just that gray area of competitiveness that has to be answered, because like you said, man, I think what's really going to be interesting, and I'm sure there's a lot of collectives out here who are a little bit nervous right now.
Oh yeah.
Because you may have really about one of three situations happen. You may have either collectives are no longer existent, and the school just foots the entire bill, and you go back to donating to boosters.
Right.
You may have a situation where the collectives are brought in house, and basically it's just like, you know, the bank of the school
right.
for this.
It's another the arm of the boosters.
Right. It's the HR department, you
That's
know,
for right.
this payroll. and then you may also have where they continue to operate independently on
right.
top of what the school is allowed to do. And you know, while you were talking, I thought I had an interesting thing where it's like, okay, well, typically you may want to allocate a certain amount of resources to football from this settlement, from this salary, so to speak. But if you can supplement that through the collective, like a strong collective, like we know
yep.
with the Battles End, then you don't really have to put as much money towards a single sport
Correct.
As it is. But I think if you bring them in house, you'll probably see like Florida State has two or three collectives. That may go down to one.
That's
that
right.
may just be one. And we know that FSU and the Battle's End already work together. They have passed where they are allowed to promote each other. And so I just think it's where do you create fairness? Because like you said, man, that $20 million salary cap is not a salary cap if you can privately pay players outside of that. If you can increase that salary cap, because you know, you may have the same $15 million roster from the school as an Alabama and Ohio State, but they may be funneling in another $25 million into that roster through the collective. That's something that's going to have to get figured out because that's really not fair at all. But again, it's going to separate the haves and the have nots. And it also, you know, again, heightens the value of this revenue gap. But I think the other thing that we have to look at that we hinted at before was the way the NCAA may look at attacking this and from a competitive advantage standpoint, because you also have to think of, on a side note before we get into that, is you also have to balance out this with Title IX and stuff like that. So, you know, the one question that has to be answered as well is there is no literature to my knowledge yet that says that with Title IX, you have to be presented the same opportunity.
Correct. Not the same
as male sports, but not the same pay. So will there be something in there where the female sports have to be paid the same as male sports? And that would be because again, I mean, this is no dish against women's sports. I mean, I love our women's soccer team and our softball team and all that, but we know the main revenue driver is male sports, particularly football. So they would get the lion's share of that $20 million salary cap. But you still have to balance all that out. And so this is maybe something where you see schools start to cut their sports, like Stanford, a recent addition to the ACC, has one of the largest sports umbrellas in all of college football or all of college sports. So you may see them have, you know, they got rowing and all this type of stuff that, you know, that may have to be, you know, we might have to make some cuts to the polo team. You know, oh gosh, I'm sorry. I'm sure those kids can't afford to pay their own way, you know, but you may see some of that stuff. But again, man, I think it's interesting. And so the way the NCAA is looking at considering kind of fixing this issue is with scholarship and roster changes. And so you may see a situation where we go to an all scholarship format.
Right.
So in college football, the way it works right now is you can have 120 players on the roster, but only 85 scholarships.
Correct.
So you may end up seeing them negotiate down to say 100 players, but they're all on scholarship.
Correct.
So while that's not a huge deal, I don't think as far as from the paying extra, because you have, you know, what we call now NIL scholarships where, you know, Florida State might have 85 scholarship guys, but you might have 100 guys who aren't paying for school.
Correct.
Through NIL deals. And that could still exist, you know, in the form until we figure out what they're going to do with these collectives. But it does help to a degree that the other sports like baseball who cannot cover their full roster with scholarships because they don't have that many to give.
Right.
It would definitely benefit the non-football sports, but that's going to be a way that they're going to look at limiting this. But to me, until you figure out the salary cap, it doesn't limit anything because, again, look at the Moneyball example we used earlier. I mean, the New York Yankees and the Oakland A's have two different – they have the same roster rules, but they pay entirely different amounts. Exactly. So it's not – it's just this provides structure, but it doesn't provide – it doesn't stop the competitive advantage of the haves and the have-nots if you allow those collectives to just funnel money into this thing.
Exactly.
You know, still.
I think the best structure that college football should look at, and I know we don't want college football to become pro football. We don't want it to become semi-pro football. But I do think now that it's moved into a structure where we're paying players, I do think we have to look at the NFL's model for this. I do think eventually Congress is going to have to determine that players are employees. That determination, that law would then allow players to unionize, to come together and then collectively bargain, which would then create a real salary cap. You look at the NFL, they have a salary cap. So I'm just going to throw out a number there. I don't know what the actual salary cap is right now, but let's just say the NFL salary cap is somewhere around, I don't know, $255 million. Dollars. Okay. So each team has $255 million to pay. Basically, what that means is that there's a hard cap, $255 million. They cannot go over that number. Right. And so if college players and the college commission, well, let me go back real quick. Here's what really needs to happen. They need to go to these super conferences. So you have the two big or three big super conferences, and then you need one commissioner and then the sub-commissioner of each miniature conference. That one commissioner then negotiates with the player union of college football, and they come up with a true salary cap. So let's say that, you know, schools can't spend over, the Power Three conferences can't spend over $50 million on their roster. That's a salary cap. Now you're going to have competitive balances. That's right. Why the NFL, that's why dynasties like the like New England are rare, are few and far between, because you have competitive balance across the league that you can't sign. You know, you don't have Ohio State, Alabama, Texas, and all of them who have the most money signing all these five-star players, getting all of these five-star transfers, and then everybody else is kind of getting the leftovers. Like, that would solve that problem, but it won't start until Congress. This is a wild thing, but yeah, it won't start till Congress actually makes that jurisdiction. And right now, there have been several bills drafted for Congress to make that decision, but it has not been what they would deem, you know, the most important issue, which, you know, I'm not trying to get political. It's understandable. Right. There's so much more else that's going on in the world. But until that happens, you're going to have these situations where every 10 years, the NCAA is going to find a way to renegotiate that thing. And then that's what's going to happen. Some players are going to rise up. They're going to come to the NCAA because that settlement, if it goes through, Jesse, again, we have to make sure we point this out. That's a 10-year deal. After 10 years, if players want, if there is no collective bargaining, if players want to get together and re-sue the NCAA again, they can, right? And so then you're back at the same stage. And so this won't ever get better, or at least get to the place that it would be the most healthiest, until they get congressional action. You're going to see these schools, these whatever schools with the most money, dominate because they have the most money to be able to pay the best. I also think real quick that too, what you're also going to see is because schools now will, if this goes through, will not have to pay their players. I think you're going to see, I'm predicting you're going to see a reduction of coaches' salaries. And I'm not saying that current coaches are going to lose money. I'm just saying new coaches coming into head coaching salaries or anything like that. You're long gone are the days of the $10 million coach after he wins a national championship. Long gone are the days of the $2 million offensive or defensive coordinators, because they just won't have the money. Even these big name schools won't have the necessary monies because they're trying to get the best players.
Yeah. And I think a couple of interesting points to that is, first off, when you talk about a salary cap, and when you look at this $20 million number, in its current structure, in its current form with NIL, that number is extremely low.
Low.
You have some rosters here who probably take up half of that budget right now, you know, and that's without them freely being able to spend it from a school's perspective. This is only from the collective. So if you add in that $20 million, I mean, that number's going to go up. That number's not going to go very far.
Correct.
But I think it does speak to the issue of not having that governing body right now as it is, because you have to go to the government. You have to go to Congress to even get this action to be taken care of, because there is no one looking over the sport of college football as a whole. It sure the heck ain't the NCAA, because they're not doing anything. So I think that is an important thing to have that structure provided from the government perspective until you can get that governing body who can do this for you. Because we've said this 100 times before. I mean, it creates a very big competitive disadvantage to have the revenue gap in college sports, but I cannot at all blame the schools who have that competitive disadvantage for using it. I would love for Florida State to have a $20 million advantage over Miami or whatever it is. I would love for that to happen, but it's just not the case as long as you're in the ACC. So I think you can't blame them for doing that. And they're gonna keep running with that banner until someone stops them. They have no reason not to. So you have to have some kind of action to do that. And then I think that's how you move to fair. Now, what that number is, we don't know. How you get to that number will remain to see. Is it that partially from the college, partially from the collective? You know, where does that number come into? You know, how do we come to that number remains to be seen. And there's a lot of details that are going to have to be worked out. But, you know, again, like we said, if this, there's so many unknowns. But if some of the unknowns get answered in the way that it should, where you get that salary cap, I think it's going to be good for the game. I mean, you know, the gig is up, man. You got to start paying these players. It's been this way for a long time. And I saw something in an article earlier over at the College Huddle. By the way, shout out to the College Huddle. If you guys haven't heard about them, go check them out. It's a collection of over 70 plus podcasts. Our founder, Eric Boggs, has a great write-up on this over at the College Huddle that will help make sense of all this stuff. That's where a good bit of my information is coming from as well. So check out the College Huddle. We're excited to be working out with those guys all season. But, you know, I think when you look at this, man, you have I think they said that he said there was like 200 and something million in coaching buyouts paid in 2023 alone.
Wow.
So like the insane amount of money that's being thrown around in college athletics as it is now, you're going to have to pay these guys eventually. Yep. It was going to have to get here.
Oh,
you
just,
you did it in an unregulated way that came out of the fans' pocket. Now you're going to have it in a more regulated way that comes from these schools who have frankly been getting fat off this money for a long time. I mean, you look at all the you know, Clemson's football mansion, you look at the $10 million coaches, like you said, the two and the $1 and $2 million coordinators. These schools got the money. It's not the fans shouldn't be supporting this anyway. That was a flawed system to begin with, because that money can only go so far. But I think that it will be good for the game. It just depends on how the gray areas get cleared up in the next few months and weeks as this thing finally gets agreed upon. Because, yeah, you'll have some structure, but it's like a house of cards structure. You know, it's not creating fairness if you allow the salary cap, but also allow teams to funnel in additional money on top. It really didn't change anything. You're just ensuring that more people are getting paid, more people get their hand in the pot, which is not a bad thing. But yeah, I think it will eventually be good for the sport, but it's got a long way to go. And the competitive disadvantage of revenue is still there as it currently stands and is still the biggest issue in college sports right now.
Well, you know, I mean, just going back to even the fans' perspective, I mean, you think about this. Technically, the reason why we're in this situation right now is because back in 2014, remember we talked about this in a couple episodes ago, is that the NCAA ruled that, the courts ruled that the NCAA's model for student athletes and how we pay and all that stuff was illegal, that we were preventing free marketing capitalism for student athletes. And so basically they said, hey, you've been operating for 100 years in an illegal model, basically, right? And fans, we have been covering the expense. You get millions upon millions upon millions of dollars from TV revenue. You get millions of dollars every year from ticket sales from the fans. You get millions of dollars from revenue from concessions. You get millions of dollars of revenue from merchandise purchasing. You get millions of dollars revenue from booster, like us giving money to the school for projects like buildings, all that stuff. And our benefit, our only benefit, the only product we've seen that we get from it is hopefully, you know, some wins and a championship, right? That's it. Whereas the school, the players, they got a full ride to school. So that was great, right? They got education. Yeah. That was awesome. But the schools got a windfall of billions of dollars, right? And so now with the court saying, hey, nah, that's not going to fly, we went to this collective model. And guess what we did? We put the onus on the fans again to continue to contribute to that. Well, now the courts have come back and said, no. If you're going to do this, this has got to be on the school. And so I'm just wondering, like, what does that look like going forward when it's getting costlier to go to games? It's getting costlier to keep subscription on cable and all like that to watch games. It's getting costlier to buy merchandise and all those things. At what point? Like when you look at the NFL, again, not that we want to be pro sport. When you look at the NFL, our cost as a fan for the NFL is really tickets, merchandise, right? Yeah. Travel and all that stuff. That's it. We don't give, like, I'm a Rams fan. I don't give to the Rams collective to pay players. I don't give that.
Right. Well, and I think another interesting thing too is the model that you're talking about is why a lot of us feel that NIL is not sustainable, because this money is not going to last forever. You know, if a recession were to hit or something like that, that's probably going to be one of the first things they cut. All these gigantic money boosters, like the guy who owns a car lot that we saw in Florida's case with Jaden Rashada.
Yeah.
How often are these guys going to keep giving $3 and $4 and $10 million when let's be honest, you can have whoever you want reading, an ad for you. Like, I'm not going to go buy a $70,000 Cadillac because Jameis Winston tells me to buy a $70,000 Cadillac. I do it according to my budget.
I'll go get some crab legs.
Right. So like, I don't know how long this model was going to last. So I think it was unsustainable to begin with.
Absolutely.
And so now, like you said, man, I think it's good to put the onus back on the schools a little bit who make all this money. I mean, you're talking about these schools are spending $10 million on a coach and all these money on things. And like, you know, I donate to boosters. I donate to the battles. And nobody sent me an ACC championship ring. I want one of them things.
Where my ring at?
I'm part of the team, you know, and my funds help with this.
That's right.
probably not enough, but you know, whatever. But at the same time, no, man, I think you're right. I think you bring up a good point. I think the current model was unsustainable, and now putting it back on the onus of the school, it'll just provide some stability for years down the road.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. I think what this will allow is that now we can actually see see the fans actually our costs get corrected. And yeah. And again, listen, I know you do too. I love being a Battles End member. I love being a booster.
We donate because we want to.
We donate because we want to. But at some point and at some time, our lives might change and we might not be able to donate. And right. I think you make such a great point. You know, if we have a recession, the first thing that's coming off my thing is this. Like,
right.
You know what I
love
mean?
Y'all mean it, but
love you mean it, but can't pay you. And so if that were to happen, what now the schools are reinforced that, well, not just reinforced, they're made to say, okay, well, we got the money. We're getting the money. It's just, we're going to have to change how we spend that money. We're not going to leverage building, you know, $10 million building projects anymore. So, you know, I'm sure there's still going to be an arms race for great buildings, but you're going to see few and far between of that now, because now they're going to have to be more concerned with, do we have enough money to get the roster we want to vie for a championship? Do we have enough money? You're going to see coaching salaries go down. You're going to see, like you said earlier, you're going to see a very concentrated and difficult conversation in athletics around, okay, well, man, do we need this lacrosse team, men and women, right? Yeah. Do we need this rowing team? Probably not, because we can't afford it. Do we need this, you know? And with Title IX, again, like you said, it doesn't require, at least right now, it doesn't require equal pay. It requires that if we have this sport for this, we have to correspond that with this same opportunity for the opposite sex. And so what does that look like? And moving forward, I think some of these decisions in 10, maybe 5 to 10 years from now, Jesse, and hopefully we're still doing this, we're going to be talking about an entirely different college sports landscape.
I agree, man. And I mean, even when you talk about the ACC versus FSU lawsuit, what you saw North Carolina come out and say 6-8 months ago was that we have a lot of sports and we cannot sustain this model of floating a lot of sports. They're going to be operating at a $17 million deficit this year and $100 million over the next 10 years. And that, I don't know if that even figures this in. That was made before this was finalized. So it could get even worse. So you may see them have to make some of these cuts. I think it's also funny that, you know, when you see some of these videos that I've seen on social media where like a college player coming from one of these power programs, you know, they go play in a bowl game or they make it to the NFL and you see the difference in the locker rooms and stuff. Oh, and like it's college has better facilities than most NFL teams.
Most NFL facilities.
Right. I mean, you're going from like this space shuttle locker to like an old wood locker or something like a high school. And it's crazy to think, but that's because they have to put all that money into the roster. And so that's what you're going to see in the college model. So that's kind of just where it's at right now. You know, we're just waiting to see how this thing gets finalized and some of the structure. Again, I think to kind of round it all up here, I think the biggest thing that you're waiting on is first off for this to just get agreed upon and put into place. When does this begin? When does this, you know, how long will this run? The 10 years, you know, because this could be, like you said, if they reject this deal, it could take another 2-3 years to get to court, to get finalized on. So we have to wait to see it be finalized. And then I think it also comes out from the framework of the NCAA following that, or Congress, like you said, how do they operate the collectives in addition to this? And then what do they do with scholarship and roster payouts and limits and things like that? That's really where the teeth of this is going to be for us as a fan perspective. There will be a lot of logistics for schools and stuff that we don't really care about. But those are the main three things. Will it pass when it goes into effect? How they work the collectives into this? Is this a hard salary cap or not?
That's right.
And then what they do with the roster and NCAA stuff outside of that. So let's talk about the need for revenue right now before we transition into baseball. And so for those of you watching on YouTube, I threw a slide up on here and I'll read it through you for you on the podcast here. But the race for revenue in college football. So looking at 2023 conference payouts per school.
My gosh.
The ACC came in at $44 million this year. The Big Ten around $60.5 million and the SEC at $51.3 million. So you're already behind. Now, if you add in the new CFP deal, that pays the ACC around $13 to $14 million per school. The Big 12 gets around $12 million, I think, but we're an ACC school, so that's what we're talking about here. Big Ten and SEC to receive $9 million more per school at $22 million. So the revenue gap as it stands right now, as far as being in the ACC versus the Big Ten or the SEC, you are approximately, if the numbers did not change in 2024, and we know that they are, I have a little note down here at the bottom that the Big Ten and SEC will be entering new media rights agreements in 2024 and 2025 with increased payouts because of expansion. We, as an ACC school, are currently behind the Big Ten, as it stands right now, around $25.5 million if the payout didn't change and the CFP revenue was added in. The SEC comes in at around $16.3 million. You're trailing as an ACC school. So the interesting thing right here, not even looking at the future budgets, because we know those are going to change. And unfortunately for the ACC, they're locked in right now. Unless they negotiate something in 2027, which why does ESPN have any reason to pay more? Right. They have no reason to. That $20 million salary, you know, check that you got to cut every year, you're already, like, basically, if you're competing ACC versus SEC versus Big Ten, that $20 million is basically free and above what you're getting paid for the Big Ten and the SEC, because you're almost at that number in just the revenue gap. So it's almost like, if you're in those two conferences, you're competing against yourself. You're barely even competing against the ACC. I mean, really, from an ACC perspective, you got to figure out how the heck to get out of here. That's priority number one. But two, you may be looking at a situation where you just have to play money ball and do the best you can. Unless, now, of course, there's different ways that you generate money outside of the TV contracts. Florida State's been really good about that, but there's only so much you can do, because we know that revenue gap is going to continue to grow. So if you're looking at throwing a $30 million cost in the laps of these schools, and you're already 16 to 25 million behind and getting worse, man, the heightened sense of getting out of here is never been greater, because of the need for money in college sports has never been greater. And I'll throw it back to you for some thoughts on this, but man, first off, I mean, what are we doing in the ACC? We're still paying John Swofford $3 million
per year
in the deal that's come out, the documents that have come out about their payouts. They're still paying the guy who crashed the conference, you know, promised a sweetheart deal to his absolutely family member for ridiculous. Raycom Sports, and is still making $3 million a year. So, man, that's just that's like salt on the wound of getting out of here. But when you look at the bill that you're about to have to foot, and you look at the revenue gap that you're already dealing with, that's only going to get worse. The need for getting out of the ACC has never been higher.
Oh my gosh. I mean, think about it. You're making, you pay out is $44 million right now. $44 million. Okay. And when the new college football invitational deal comes through, you're going to make an additional $13 to $14 million. That gets you to $58 million. Well, then you have to count, okay, well, $20 million, and probably because you're a power four school, really $30 million, right? Of that money has to be set aside. So you take that 30 off of 58, you're now down to $28 million. Yeah. Now you're already operating at even a worse deficit than you were before. Okay, now let's go to the Big Ten. Big Ten at $60.5 million, right? They're going to get an additional $22 million, upwards of $22 million. So that's about $82 million. You take off their $30 million, they're at $52 million to your $28 million. Like, I mean, you can't compete. It would take you eons before you would ever get into a competitiveness with them, because they're going to be able to get the best players. They're going to be able to hire the best coaches. They're going to be able to provide the best facilities. All those things that we said that might be, you know, changing, they're still going to be able to get the best of it because they have more money. Whereas you're just hanging afloat trying to pay your football team, your basketball team, your baseball team, all those other teams, while also shelling out money for all that. Man, there's no way. What in the world are we doing? Why are we still in this conference? Like, it is negligent. It is negligent what the ACC has allowed this conference to become. I mean, it's very clear of this. And again, like you said, the fact that our former conference commissioner literally wrote himself in the deal where he gets paid out money as if he made a successful conference, because he was able to swoop in and tear up the Big East for, you know, some programs like Virginia Tech that hasn't been Virginia Tech of old, Miami that hasn't
done anything in 20 years.
Speaking
of things that have died, exactly. Exactly. Boston College, Pitt. I mean, like, what are we doing here? Yeah. Like, if Greg Sankey had done this in the SEC or I can't think of the Big Ten commissioner, Warren, I think it might be, is his name. If they had wrote this in, you'd be like, yeah, makes sense. Look at all the success they've had. You can't say that for that. And this is why it is more important than ever. And every time we get on here, we say this. We got to get out of this godforsaken conference.
No, I mean, I agree. And some of the projections have the new Big Ten contracts in the coming years, not even down the road, at $75 to $90 million. Jeez. And I mean, it's going to get worse. And like we said, your revenue's not going to grow in the ACC. No. Not on its own accord. I mean, it has grown over the years. Like the payout has gotten a lot higher, but it's not going to grow at the pace that the other ones are growing, correct, especially when you factor in all the new programs that they've had that will bring bigger payouts. So, man, it is.
Yeah. And just this quick point, Jesse, is the fact that this doesn't get talked about very often, but the fact that the TV partner who's supposed to help you be garnering that revenue is investing most of their revenue in your competition, and they're also trashing you on television, and they're your partners. Like their co-host, their biggest game day show is literally telling the world the way their talking heads do the preseason votes and basically have like 9 SEC teams above you. Like, they're literally telling the world, don't watch the ACC. They're terrible. Even though they're supposed to be your television partners.
Right. They tell you you're a second-rate conference because, I mean, even look at the playoff spot distribution. So they tell you you're a second-rate conference. So, again, man, it's just if you want to compete on that higher level. Because it's also not like when the Power Four conferences agreed to this deal, and I think this is important too, the revenue distribution is not equal. The playoff distribution is not equal. No. But the payouts you have to spend are equal.
Yeah.
So, you exactly. know, that's like, you know, me making $50,000 a year, you making $100,000 a year, and, you know, whoever, John Smith making $150,000 a year, and we all have to live in the same neighborhood and buy the same house. Like, it's just not going to work if you want to compete at that level. Eventually, you're going to go broke trying to keep up with your neighbor. And so, like, you got to find a way out. And, you know, the only reason we're still in here is because of legal reasons, but I think that's why they're hell-bent on finding a way out of here because, again, this is something where we've talked about this before with Michael Alford and all these guys in the current leadership of Florida State. They saw this coming.
They saw this coming.
They knew
you
had to get out of here.
That's right.
Because it was going to eventually lead to, I'm not going to say like the death of your athletic department, because I still think Florida State does well and could compete. Yeah. But it's just, man, it's going to be an insurmountable hole that you're trying to dig out of constantly. And the sooner you get out, the smaller that gap's going to be over time. So, again, it's extremely important. But, I mean, that's pretty much the gist of it and how it's going to affect this. So, as new details come out, we'll make sure to keep you guys updated on that. But you know what, Michael? As crazy as times seem in college sports right now, you don't know what's coming one way or the other from day to day. You know who you can count on for great FSU gear? That's Alumni Hall FSU. So make sure you check these guys out. If you're headed to the regional in Tallahassee this weekend, they are at 1415 Timber Lane Road. Stop by, pick up some baseball gear. They have all kinds of stuff from hats and jerseys and t-shirts that you guys are going to love. They have a 2-for-$38 t-shirt deal that you can load up on some good gear for. And the best part is you can save 10% by using code SPEAR online or in-store. So that's alumnihall.com, navigate over to the FSU page, or stop and see them in Tallahassee. So, speaking of baseball, Michael, let's jump into this regional real quick. We won't go too in-depth in it, but I just want to set the stage for those who enjoy the baseball part of this podcast. So, here's the thing, man. First off, congratulations to FSU baseball.
Yeah.
You got postseason baseball back where it belongs inside Dick Houser Stadium in Tallahassee for the first time since 2018. Really excited for them to be able to host. And let's be honest, they need to host. They are, I think, 27-4 at home and 8-10 on the road. Oof. So this is huge. And the fact that you earned a top 8 national seed, which also means you get to host a super regional.
That's right.
Which, if you make it for the 12th time in program history, which also happens to be an NCAA record.
That's right.
So, again, man, that's going to be huge for you to host because of the decided advantage you have against, you know, from home to away. Now, looking at the Tallahassee regional, which starts on Friday, Florida State's first pairing is going to be against Stetson. This is a familiar opponent. We have played them twice this season. We split the two games. Florida State took the first one early in the season by a score of 1-0. Now, only 2 weeks ago, this makes you a little nervous. Stetson did grab the win.
That's right.
They were at home. We were on the road for this one by a score of 10-5. So Stetson also split series, two-game series with Florida and UCF, who's also in this regional. You have Florida State, UCF, Alabama, and Stetson. So the thing about Stetson, man, is I feel like when you go back and you look, so Stetson, when you look at RPI and your schedule rankings and your quad one wins, they're 1-4 in quad one games. That one win was against Florida State. Yep, so obviously you are going to have to be on guard. You know what I mean? Because that you are the one good win that they have. But I think when you think about it, Florida State obviously has been dealing with pitching injuries from the bullpen. And when they played Stetson, that's a midweek game. Yeah. Crazy things happen in midweek games. That's if you right. lose that, it doesn't really hurt you because of the other opponents that you have on the schedule. Well, for a team like Stetson, Florida State is one of your only quad one games. They only played five quad one games. So you're going to throw everything you have to try and get that quality win. So I think that's the matchup you see this time, if you give Stetson your better pitchers, your more of a weekend-style rotation than what they saw in the midweek, I think that makes you feel a little bit better there. But still, this is a quality team. And oddly enough, man, I saw some power rankings yesterday from a stat guy that I follow on X or Twitter. And the Tallahassee Regional, by power rankings, was the second hardest regional to win. So it's going to be a little bit tough to make it out of here to even get to that super regional. So your first opponent, like we said, is the Stetson Hatters. They are 40-20, 40 win season, coming off an A-Sun championship where they defeated Kennesaw State, who is a good team as well. Now, if you want a more in-depth write-up, I did put an article on our website, What's Ahead for Florida State in the Tallahassee Regional, where you can read a little bit more in-depth for this. So if Florida State, so go check that out at plantthespear.com. But if we get past the Hatters and we stay in the winner's bracket, you will then face the winner of UCF and Alabama. So just kind of looking at the teams here, looking at UCF, they, to me, looking at the numbers without really digging into analytics, they look like kind of the weakest of the seeds here. And they are 35-19. They do have wins over Stetson, Florida, and Miami, but they're only 4-8 in quad one games with an offense that ranks outside of the top 100 in scoring, runs per game, and batting average as a team. Now, they have a good defense. They have the best ERA and the lowest amount of runs allowed of all the teams in this regional. So they're probably going to rely on defense, but they're going to be playing Alabama. And now I will say, as far as UCF, they did beat number 19 three times this season.
Yeah.
So again, man, they have they can compete. Alabama, to me, is the sneaky team in this regional. When I was doing some research on them, now they may have the worst winning percentage of all the teams in here at 33-22, but they're 24th in RPI. The Knights, UCF, are 33rd. Looking at RPI for Stetson, they're all the way down at 100th.
Yeah,
but a lot of this has to do with that strength of schedule.
Yeah,
that they have had. They have played, and they got like Florida's football schedule in 2024. Like it is unreal. It is a top 10 strength of schedule. So keep in mind, Michael, we were mentioning earlier. So in quad one games, Florida State has played 16 quad one games. They're 8-8. Stetson has played five. They're 1-4. UCF has played 12 quad one games. They're 4-8. Alabama has played 35 quad one games.
That's wild.
That is insane. And they are 15-20 in those games. So now here's the lineup of some of the games, the highlights of the games they played. They've had series against number 1 Tennessee, number 2 Kentucky, number 4 Texas A&M, number 5 Arkansas, number 11 UGA, number 15 Mississippi State. They played a single game against number 25 Arizona, or number 18 Arizona, 25 Southern Miss, and a series against an unranked but 40-win LSU squad that just gave Tennessee all they wanted in the SEC championship. Now, they did come away with series wins against number 1 Tennessee, number 5 Arkansas, and LSU. So I think when you look at this team, that explains their record not being up to snuff of what the other teams are. They have just played an insane schedule. So the good thing, the advantage is because I'm looking at probably, you know, it being Florida State versus Alabama to decide this regional. They do have an 8-12 record in road games. So again, that home field advantage where you're decidedly better at home and they are decidedly worse on the road, that's going to be an advantage for Florida State. Now, when you look at FSU in this, they have the best offense, one of the best offense in the country, but they have the best offense in this entire regional. So when you're looking at the records here. Florida State has a strength of schedule of 26 and an RPI of 8. Stetson has a strength of schedule at 198 and an RPI of 100th. Alabama, 8th and 24th. UCF, their strength of schedule is 42nd and their RPI is 33rd. So Florida State leads the grouping in runs per game and team batting average. And they are pretty close in their defense. So really, Florida State needs their offense to step up and help them win in this game or in this regional, because we know that pitching depth has really kind of been the Achilles heel. Now, some good news that I want to share with everybody is when Link Jarrett was talking about how they're going to handle this weekend, they did say that Cam Leiter has the potential to make a return. It's looking like he'll be available this weekend, just in a limited capacity. Kind of what you've seen with Connor Whitaker, where he went from a starter to now coming out of the bullpen on a pitch count. But given that bullpen depth has been your weakness, having Cam Leiter able to give you even 20, 30 pitches, two innings, three innings, is going to be massive, because he is the second best pitcher on this rotation. And then if you make it out of this regional, maybe he's available in a larger role than he is going to be in the regional. You also have Connor Whitaker has been working his pitch count up, so you have him as well. And when they asked Link about how he's going to handle this, he says he understands that, like, where do you use Jamie at? You don't want to use Jamie Arnold, that is, their left-handed ace. You don't want to use him against Stetson. But if you don't beat him, it's a lot harder to get out of there coming from the loser side of the bracket. So you got to win games. And so they're still evaluating how they're going to use the pitching this weekend. But I think overall, when you look at this regional, I think it's Florida State is the best team here. It's just you've seen them kind of run out of gas. And this is to touch on that ACC championship game. They did really good in the ACC tournament. That's what got them that top eight national seed.
Yep.
Then they got smoked by Duke in that ACC championship. But, you know, we don't typically call players out or say anything bad about players on the show individually. But, man, when I saw they put in Tejada in the pitch, I was like, oh, I mean, we're cooked. We're
done.
Like we are scraping the meat off the bottom of the pan. You know what I mean? It's just you ran out of gas. And I think the interesting thing, too, is when you look at these three-game series throughout the season, a lot of times you go in, you try and get that Friday win to set the tone. Then you try and follow it up with your best pitching on Saturday. And then Sunday is where usually you see the opposite team win or you get blown out or something. It just doesn't match the other scores. That happened with Duke earlier this season. Florida State did win the regular season series against Duke. But this was almost like the game three, because you played Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
That's right.
You just had to throw out what you had. So the reason I say that is because if you make it past this regional, you are paired with the Oklahoma regional.
That's right. Yeah.
Guess who's out there in the Oklahoma region?
Oh, boy.
Duke. So you may have to play Duke for a fourth time this season, or Oklahoma. But the hope is when you get to that super regional, you can give them 2 days of your best pitching, and then you've won the series. You don't have to go to that game three, because you wouldn't even have to play it now, because the series would be over. So I think Florida State is the best team in this regional. But I do think that it's going to depend on the pitching health, which they've got Ben Barrett back as well. So they're as healthy as they have been since the beginning of the season. But you have the best offense, you have a comparable defense, and you should win. But Alabama is going to be my biggest concern. But again, it starts by getting past Stetson, because you can't overlook them. But I think this is a tough but winnable regional for Florida State. And then you'll turn your focus on the super regional, and thankfully you get the host.
Yeah, man. I think I got to watch the baseball selection show preview, and it was really cool to see. You know, I think Stetson, when they saw that they were in the Tallahassee regional again, they got jacked. They got juiced. Yeah. Like they're not like, oh gosh, Tallahassee. They're like, oh yeah, because they beat us once. Yeah, I think it was there at their place.
It was.
But they got to come to Tallahassee and play us again. And like you said, I think this time around, Florida State will be able to kind of throw the big guns at them, which will hopefully and likely overwhelm them. The biggest interest, like you said, is that Alabama team. I mean, gosh, you know, 35 quad one games. That is absolutely ridiculous. As you were saying that, I was thinking about the, you know, Roll Tide Willie. He's like, hey, give nothing about the Tide. Blitz, Bama blitz. Like, that's what I kept thinking. Like, they don't care. They'll play anybody, anywhere, anytime. They have gone through the gauntlet. So if there's a team that you want to be weary of, going into that Tallahassee regional, it would be Alabama. Now, UCF, yes, they've beat Oklahoma State three times. And my son's going to the UCF baseball camp, so I have nothing bad to say about them.
Right.
I want you to treat my son well, but you might have a difficult time in the Tallahassee regional. Yeah. But we'll see. I think it's going to be a great regional. I just, you know, my hope is that if they're able to win that regional, you're basically, because you became a national eight seed, if you play well, you can ride out at home all the way to Omaha. You could literally play all the way at home to Omaha, which, again, Florida State 27-4 at home. They're better at home than they are on the road. And so this is a great opportunity if they can find a way to put together those three great games, get to the Super Regional, get some revenge, probably, you know, maybe against Duke or play Oklahoma and maybe get some revenge for the girls softball team and then see ourselves. Jesse, wouldn't it be a great opportunity to return to Omaha in year two of Link's tenure? No.
It would be huge, man. I mean, hopefully, again, we saw earlier in the season where Hauser was packed over 6,000 people for like all the Florida and Miami games. So you're hoping you get that home field advantage from a crowd perspective. Hopefully there's a little, you know, Mike Martin magic floating around as well. Maybe you have something similar to that, like 2019 run.
What a run.
You get to have it at home. So that will definitely be a decided advantage. But yeah, man, I mean, really, like when you look at it, it's just Florida State had kind of a bad shake of things where later in the season, when you were playing your toughest games, you lost a lot of your pitching due to health reasons. So if you get them back, you still feel like you're the best team in this regional. It's just, man, if you want to tie this into football, this is kind of like the conversation we've been having about the CFP going forward, where you may have an SEC team that's, you know, 9-3 up against an ACC team that's 11-1. But when you look at that gauntlet of the schedule they've had to go through, you understand why maybe that 9-3 record is better than that 11-1 record, just depending on how it looks and what you played. So I think Alabama is the sneaky team there. But again, man, you got to get past Stetson. And you might, I mean, who knows? Upsets happen all the time, especially in baseball. You could end up facing UCF. And out of the Oklahoma regional, just so everybody's on the same page, the other two teams are Oral Roberts and UConn. So maybe unlikely that they make it out. But, man, either way, you're going to have a difficult challenge in the super regional if you make it that far. Now, the regional starts on Friday, May 31st, with the Florida State taking on Stetson at noon on ACC Network. Game two is Alabama against UCF at 6 p.m. on ESPN+. So, man, I'm just really excited to kind of see how things shake out, how they decide to use this pitching. What is Cam Leiter's health status? Do we actually see him make a return? Because, you know, I was talking to our baseball guy, Jeff, and you know, maybe we can go into a more in-depth preview later this week for something. But if you don't get Cam Leiter back, it feels like it's going to be a tall task to, one, make it out of the regional, or two, make it out of a super regional, especially in the regional if you fall to the loser's bracket, just from having depth of arms. But, man, if you can get Whitaker back at a higher pitch count and Leiter back in any shape or form, it's really going to change the outlook of how your postseason is going to look.
Yeah.
But if you have those guys, and like you said, if you can make that run to Omaha, no matter what happens out there, I think you feel really good about what the season turned out to be, knowing that you've had to deal with some of the challenges you've had to deal with injuries as well. But again, I mean, you're getting healthy and you feel like you should be able to make it out of this regional, but it's not going to be easy.
Not going to be easy. Not going to be easy, bro. And, you know, I was just thinking, like, gosh, wouldn't it be great if what we went through this season with that bullpen and all the different times they've blown games or cost us games or even saved some of the games, if they were able to finally put it all together, if you could see Link's vision for this bullpen of him, you know, consistently trusting them and putting them in these high leverage situations and not really producing a lot of times, but then they were able to put it all together. Man, if that bullpen could rise up, this team could, I'm not saying they could win it all, but they could get pretty darn close to winning it all. If this bullpen could play to the potential that I think the reason why this coaching staff put them in those situations to help them grow in that sense of getting there as well too. But yeah, I think, you know, again, if they don't take this seriously, they could very quickly find themselves on the losing end of this as well.
Yeah, no, I agree, man. And the thing is, the bullpen has not been bad. It's just been inconsistent. It's won you some games, then it's lost you some games. So they just really need to find their footing and be consistent. But the good thing is, you know, sometimes we're like, we sure go through a lot of pitchers, you know. Yes, we're bringing like we're bringing people out of the you know Section B Animals crew to come down here and pitch at some point. But I think the important thing is now by the postseason, you know who you got, you know who you can trust, and like you said, you put them in them high leverage situations. I mean, you put a guy like we talked about with Tejada in the ACC title game where. Let's be honest. He probably had no business pitching at that point in his career. That's not to say he can't turn out to be a great pitcher.
Exactly.
Just not right now. But now you've seen those guys in high leverage situations. So when you get to this postseason play, you know what you got. You know who you can trust. And hopefully you get a couple guys back, which, again, getting Ben Barrett, Cam Leiter, and Connor Whitaker back is going to be really huge for you. So we'll just see how it plays out, man. Yeah. But I'm really excited to see postseason baseball back in Dick Houser Stadium where it belongs.
Yeah, back in Tallahassee.
Right. It's going to be an electric atmosphere at Houser, and I can't wait to see it. But that's pretty much going to do it for us today,
wait,
guys.
Now, Jesse, hold on a second. Wait, we didn't talk about the Miami region.
Oh yeah, that's right. They don't have one.
They don't have one. Oh man. Okay. I'm sorry. I must have been mistaken.
But you know, you do have the one right down the road in Gainesville. Wait.
No, never mind.
Never mind. Never mind. So man,
Miami didn't even make the tournament.
Exactly. Like it's really nice to just see where Florida State season took them.
That's right.
But like we said on the last show, now is where you have to go out and make it mean something.
That's right.
You know, winning 42 games means something. Trust me, it's not something that will be overlooked. But now's where it pays off. Yes. Just like the 13-0 up until the snub. Mm. It was great, but it doesn't mean a whole lot because you didn't capitalize on it. There's recruiting and things like that where it matters
for sure.
But now's where it's money, and you got to make it count. So I'm excited to see where these guys go. I mean, if the bats show up alone. Oof. They have the offense to carry them out of this regional. It's just the pitching is going to have to show up to match as well. And, you know, I don't envy Link on having to decide on how to disperse resources, but I'm sure he'll figure it out. I think this is his fourth time as a head coach hosting a regional at different universities. So he's experienced. Yeah. He knows what it takes to get there. You know, they did the unthinkable with Notre Dame a couple of years ago, trying to really getting a impressive series run there. So, man, I can't wait to see it play out. I'm going to be a little nervous because I really want us to do well.
Yep.
You know, but that's going to – yeah, man, I get so mad. Like, it's funny the other day, and we'll end on this, but I was watching the Duke game, and of course, you guys know, most of you know, that I live in Charlotte, and I was thinking about going, and thank goodness I didn't, but I'm glad I did because I'm just watching it at home on TV. I had to work that night, so I woke up a little early to watch it. I was just getting so mad, you know, like the second Grand Slam, I'm like – I'm glad I'm not there because I'd be power slamming a Duke fan, you know, off the dugout or something. Yeah. Like, man, it's just you just want to see him win, man. So I'm hoping best of luck to those guys in this regional. I know they're going to do well. I know Link's going to have them ready, but I'm just excited to see how this goes. But guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure you check out Alumni Hall FSU and support those that support us. Drop a like and subscribe or rate and review on the podcast if you enjoyed this episode. Of course, we appreciate everybody tuning in. And we will be back with you with some different shows over the next couple weeks. Michael is going to be out of the country.
Yeah,
he's dipping out on us for a little bit. So we're going to have some different faces on here appearing over the next few weeks. So I think I got some plans that you guys will enjoy for some shows coming up. So make sure you stay tuned to us. And again, check out plantthespear.com where we have that baseball article previewing the Tallahassee Regional, as well as all of our other content. So thank you guys so much for tuning in. And as always, go Noles.
Go Noles.